We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me this week for an episode all about a more contemporary film than we used to. We're talking today about Martin Scorsese's The Aviator from 2004, which I'm sure you'll recall stars Leonardo DiCaprio as Howard Hughes. And I'm delighted to be joined by a returning guest on this one, Darren Mooney. Hey, Darren.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going all right. How is life in the age of lockdown for you? Because we're recording this in mid-April, I should say. So, yeah.
Q-U-A or... Yeah, no, it's going great, as you can imagine. And actually, I'm quite curious when you kind of pick this movie. I think, obviously, there are any number of reasons why this is a great choice to do for the Movie Palace, although, as you point out, it's a bit more of a contemporary film. Either that, or I'm much older than I think I am. I think that's the first time the Movie Palace has covered, like, I've been invited on to talk about a film released within my cinematic lifetime, so thank you for that.
Yep.
But when you picked it, actually, was that a consideration? Because I was watching it, and it didn't really dawn on me until the opening scene, until I was actually sitting down and watching it, that this is perhaps a perfect movie for this moment in time.
Believe it or not, that was not intentional. When I put the idea to you, that didn't occur to me until a few days later, and then it didn't fully dawn on me what I'd done until I sat down to watch the film. I'd forgotten all about that tableau that we open with, you know. And my thought process was much simpler. It was just, last year we did an episode on Stan and Ollie, which was the first time we'd covered a new film with a connection to old Hollywood. And we also did an episode on Karina Longworth's book about Howard Hughes. And I just thought covering The Aviator would be a nice way to kind of sort of follow those episodes to a certain extent. But also, you know, this is a film that's, you know, it's what, 16 years old at this point?
Yeah.
So kind of just kind of branch out and expand what the podcast is doing. So yeah, those connections didn't fully dawn on me until later, I'm afraid. But yeah, delighted to have you here. And I think before we talk about The Aviator, it might be interesting to talk about Martin Scorsese in general before we get onto this particular film. I mean, this could be the subject of an entire podcast episode on its own, but I don't know, Darren, what are your thoughts on Scorsese in general? Like, why do you think many of us regard him as such a notable figure in, you know, in the world of filmmaking?
Well, Scorsese is kind of one of those rare figures who managed to emerge as part of the kind of new wave Hollywood in the 70s, along with figures like, say, you know, Steven Spielberg on one extreme, Brian De Palma on the other, William Friedkin kind of somewhere between them, Francis Ford Coppola kind of in that negative space. So he kind of came of age as that kind of young pop filmmaker pushing the boundaries of what was happening in Hollywood. But what's interesting about Scorsese is that while you ended up with basically two major career paths for the directors coming out of that. The obvious one, the big one, is the Spielberg path, where you go on, you become a blockbuster filmmaker, you become a crowd pleaser, you become like an institution of American cinema that is adored by the general public, where you're one of the few directors whose marquee name can basically guarantee a box office return. Or you go the route of somebody like, say, Friedkin, or arguably even Coppola, despite the fact Coppola directed, you know, some of the best movies of all time, which is you kind of flare out, you explode, you kind of become this cult figure who exists at the margins, who, you know, in some cases struggle to get movies made. If you get movies made, they end up going around the festival circuit, things like, say, Bug or Killer Joe for Friedkin, for example, or, you know, even kind of Coppola's later or more recent kind of output, where there's a sense of it existing on the margins. And I think what makes Scorsese so interesting and so compelling, and I think so alluring to people like me, and I don't mean to speak for, you know, all cinephiles or people who love cinema or anything like that, but just personally, what I think appeals to me about Scorsese is the fact that he exists in the space between those two extremes, where he is a director who can be intensely populist, who can be insanely accessible. And again, you know, the cliche of like the poster for Goodfellas on every college room dorm, you know, the kind of the way in which, you know, lines from Casino have become kind of incorporated into everyday dialogue and that sort of stuff. But also at the same time, being a director who is willing to be more obscure, to do films like, for example, Condon, to pick an example, but even Silence, if you want to go more recent, but even, say, the Netflix documentaries that he's done, you know, that he's done covering artists and kind of low-budget films or kind of small films that people will never really seek out, and yet being able to balance that with being kind of a crowd-pleasing, award-winning director. And the fact that there's a genuine love of cinema in his work, but that love of cinema is never exclusionary. It's never sort of kind of showing off. It's never really a sense of, well, if you don't understand what I'm referencing, this film clearly isn't for you. Instead, it's a very welcoming and very broad sense of cinema, where it's like, as a teenager watching Scorsese films, I would have missed a lot of the references, a lot of the loving kind of homages, a kind of a lot of the nods that he kind of put into his work. And I never felt like I was missing anything. They were just folded in so naturally. But as I come back as an adult, I'm like, oh yeah, I can see the affection, the love for classic Hollywood in here. I mean, you know, he obviously went on to do Hugo kind of a couple of years after he did The Aviator, which is the most obvious example. But even in The Aviator itself, which is, you could argue, like, a love letter to classic Hollywood. That's why we're talking about it here on this particular podcast. But even then, it's never the only thing that the film is. You could, like, when I watched this in 2004, I would have been, what, probably about 16, 17? I wouldn't have had a clue about classic Hollywood, and yet I was able to watch it and get a lot from it and understand it and appreciate it and kind of see it as a more universal story as well as a celebration of kind of Hollywood history. And so that ability to be those kind of contradictory, kind of complicated things is a large part of why I'm drawn to Scorsese as a filmmaker.
Yes, I've got a lot of appreciation for filmmakers with tenacity, people who just keep going, you know. It's why somebody like Clint Eastwood, for instance, is one of my favourite directors. And in terms of Scorsese, I think he's been able to maintain a level of artistic integrity through his career that is quite astonishing to behold, I think. I think something like The Irishman, it demonstrates that he's still an incredibly kind of vital force, at least as far as I see it. Whereas you can't always say that of all of his contemporaries, who people he sort of came of age with. I think in general terms, he's somebody, isn't he, who's, he's got this unnerving ability to kind of marry the content of his projects with a command of film technique. You know, I think he's this kind of high stylist. He can impose a stamp on pretty much anything, but in a way that's very supple, I think. So if you think of a film like Goodfellas, all sorts of like virtuoso techniques on display in that film. You know, the one I always think of first is the long and broken shot through the back of the restaurant in that film.
Cabana,
that one, and you know, many of those kind of things are still in evidence in something like The Irishman, but they're inflected very differently in that film. You know, that's another film that opens with a long and broken shot, but one that takes on a very different character to that example from Goodfellas. And I suppose just more broadly, the fluctuations in style between his projects, they always seem very appropriate to me. Is that kind of how you see it, or what?
Yeah, well, in terms of like being a director who can accomplish almost anything, and again, who has survived everything that's been thrown at him. I mean, you know, and what's interesting is that you look at Scorsese's filmography and you go back and you discuss, people talk about things like the 80s being a lost decade for Scorsese, or Scorsese discussing his time in the wilderness. And you look at that, like the output that he generated between Raging Bull and Goodfellas, and you're like, directors would aspire their entire careers to have like a period of 5 or 6 years that are as good as Scorsese's inverted commas kind of lost decade. And I think that you're entirely right about the thing, the artistry of Scorsese. And again, that speaks to kind of the accessibility of it, where Scorsese is an absolute master of craft. He knows exactly what he's doing. He loves the art form in which he's working. And everything in his films is kind of very carefully designed, very carefully put together, but never in a way that feels alienating or kind of showboaty. And again, you have this discussion where, and it's particularly common nowadays, where stuff like digital, you know, film has made it easier to do things like to, you know, one fakes, to put together long takes that aren't actually long takes. There's several long takes stitched together. And so you end up with this kind of showboating from directors about, oh, look at the technique and craft I'm employing here. Pay attention to my art, dammit. And what I really like about Scorsese is that it never really feels like it's showboating. It's that point that you made about marrying form and function, the story that he's telling with the storytelling he's using to tell it, where there are absolutely masterful shots and compositions, particularly in The Aviator. And I mean, we'll probably talk a little bit about the like technical prowess that went into it, where everything is so carefully designed, the way in which he shot it, the way in which he colored the film, the look, the texture of the film is all very carefully chosen and very carefully drawn from Hollywood history. But at the same time, all of that serves to underline the themes and the stories that he's telling. And it never feels like it's just an example of Scorsese going, look at what I'm doing. It's more like, I'm doing this thing and the way that it looks is part of that. And it's a remarkable kind of balance of form and function, which you very rarely see, and particularly with a director of that age, particularly with a director who is arguably kind of set in their ways. I mean, I also love Clint Eastwood. I think Clint Eastwood's one of the great American directors. If I had a criticism of some of Eastwood's more kind of recent work, it's that it feels very much like it's that desire to churn and to get content out there kind of like in one movie a year, which again is a level of production which would daunt younger filmmakers. But there's a sense of kind of a lack of polish to it, a sense of, well, this thing interests me, so I'm making the movie now and I'm going to release it, and this thing's going to interest me next year, so I'll make that movie and release it then. And with Scorsese, there's always a sense of what he does being kind of carefully crafted and very carefully put together, but without showing off, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, with someone like Eastwood, with a lot of his more recent films, you see these scenes in them and you just sort of think, surely, Clint, there was time for another take or two. You know?
Yeah. Maybe not at that rate of production.
Yeah, it's more like the golf course was calling at 5 p.m. or whatever.
Well, the next film needed to start production in 3 weeks, which is kind of... Because he's like one or two films a year from a director at his age is astonishing. So I remain pleased that the Eastwood films are coherent in the way that they are. Yeah, and the fact that they're not like the Woody Allen, I know, obviously there are other reasons, other concerns about Woody Allen, but when Woody Allen was doing a film a year or working that voraciously, you're like, okay, well, at least, you know, they're dialogue-heavy, performance-driven films. So, you know, the kind of work that goes into them, you know, maybe it isn't as demanding technically as something like Eastwood, where Eastwood is doing these films a year and he still manages to do these kind of virtuosa kind of sequences. Mm-hmm. Like, there are a lot of problems.
The Hereafter is the one I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah, well, the Hereafter's one as well, but even the kind of bomb, you know, the bomb sequence that happens in his most recent one. And again, you know, there are a lot of problems with that film, and there's a sense of, really, Clint, you're doing that? But, like, you watch sequences like the sort of bomb exploding in that sequence, bomb exploding in the park, and you're like, yes, this is really impressive work that you're doing. And you're doing it in, you know, one film a year, roughly, which is quite impressive, again, for a director his age. But Scorsese, you know, in contrast, always seems like he's much more, you know, he always seems like his craft is much finer, much more considered. But never really feels alienating or kind of artisanal in that way, which is a remarkable balance between those two extremes.
Yeah, and I think... that's what, you know, we can sort of tease out this connection between Scorsese and old Hollywood a bit more, which you can sort of compare him to some of the older figures I know that he's very influenced by, for instance. But yeah, you mentioned Hugo's kind of a love letter to silent cinema. We're going to talk about The Aviator. You can also think of like the old style aesthetic to something like New York, New York, the fact that he remade Cape Fear, the fact that he made a sequel to The Hustler. But also, I think another important facet of his kind of stature is... just that his interviews demonstrate such a zest for cinema, don't they, of all kinds. I mean, he's a man I've always enjoyed listening to on the subject of films. And that, I suppose that's kind of been complicated in some respects for some people in the last few months. But, you know, I've always found it an education to listen to Scorsese.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're alluding there to the infamous, you know, Marvel are not cinema argument, which is an argument I reject wholeheartedly. They are very much cinema. But I think that, like, if anybody's earned the right to say that, it's Scorsese. And he's speaking, you know, from his position as somebody who has put a lot of thought, a lot of consideration into it. And it's not even just the interviews. It's the art of restoration that he invests in. Like, Scorsese is a champion of film, and it's like restoring all these old classic kind of films and bringing them to the mass again. But not even that. It's world cinema as well. Like, I mean, Scorsese has come under criticism, and, you know, maybe earned, maybe not, but in terms of kind of, you know, his preference for films that are driven by men in particular, like white men, and kind of like arguments about diversity. But if you look at the films that he produces and the films that he attaches his brand to, Martin Scorsese Presents, he's done a lot in terms of bringing world cinema to the masses and bringing films by female filmmakers, by bringing films by minority filmmakers, and trying to elevate them and to get eyes cast on them. Scorsese adores cinema, and it's not just classic cinema, although it's very much, you know, informed by that love of history, but it's just cinema as an art form that is vibrant and kind of exciting in general. And that's why I tend to, you know, I think he's maybe a little bit overzealous in his critique of certain trends in modern cinema. You know, I think that, you know, the Marvel movies are cinema. I also think that himself and Spielberg, you know, when they were worried about the implosion of the market when superhero movies fail as well, I think that, you know, maybe there's a little bit of kind of melodrama and kind of like heightened paranoia around that, but I also understand where it's coming from, because, you know, we have had the death of the mid-budget movie in recent years. And while Scorsese is somebody who has the luxury of going to Netflix. And, you know, as we're recording this, you know, going to Netflix again and saying, give me a budget of $160, but actually $173 million to make, you know, The Irishman, because I want to de-age my buddies in it, which is, you know, as somebody who loves cinema, I'm like, give me. But as somebody who's like, if I were investing my money in it, I'd be, is this really a viable kind of investment model? But even things like he's recently said that he's probably going to have to go to Apple TV or Netflix again for the Killer of the Flower Moon, the movie that he's making with Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. And he's kind of talked about how, I think late last year when he's touring with The Irishman, he said that, like, even today, I could not get a movie made like Shutter Island. I could not get a movie made like The Departed. And most pointedly, in regards to the conversation we're having now, I could not get a movie made like The Aviator. And I think that, you know, I understand where that anxiety comes from. And I think a lot of it is earned. I'm not as kind of, you know, downbeat about the future of cinema. I think that cinema is evolving and changing and always has been. I think that, you know, streaming services have actually done a fair amount to champion voices that maybe wouldn't have made it into the mainstream otherwise. Look at, say, Netflix's support of filmmakers like Dee Reese, for example. Look at the long-term partnerships that you have with people like Ryan Murphy, for example, even in television, Shonda Rhimes in television. But you have this idea of kind of like investing in and kind of bringing different voices to the mass. I think Netflix has done a lot, for example, in making world cinema accessible to people. You have people watching Narcos, films and TV shows with subtitles that they probably would be less likely to go to the cinema to see because they see it as kind of a sunk investment with a Netflix subscription. And you have Netflix, you know, championing artists and kind of giving them a platform, giving them budgets and less oversight than they would have had in the modern studio system. But I also understand, you know, I miss going to the cinema and seeing something like The Aviator. I miss sitting in a dark room, having the lights go down and watching something like Shutter Island. You know, I think that, like, while I'm less downbeat about it than Scorsese is, while I don't think cinema is dying or dead, or even, you know, particularly at risk in inverted commas, I do think it's changing. And as somebody who loves the way that cinema was, and who loves the, you know, the kind of cinema that Scorsese, you know, brings back in films like Hugo, but also films like The Aviator, I feel that nostalgic kind of pining underpinning it. I do feel a little sad that, you know, The Irishman couldn't have been made with Paramount as he originally intended and kind of, you know, shown in cinemas in an exclusive window and becoming, you know, an event of itself. But I also feel glad that, you know, even if Paramount weren't going to pay for it, Netflix ponied up the cash, gave him everything he wanted, and he ended up with a film that has absolutely no artistic compromise in it whatsoever. You know, it's a two-sided coin, and I kind of get that when it comes to Scorsese. And I think that his concern comes from a place of sheer love for cinema. So I don't begrudge it, if that makes sense.
It makes complete sense. And I didn't agree with everything he said on a literal level. Like, are Marvel films cinema? Yeah, of course they are. I broadly was more on Scorsese's side than on many of his detractors, I'll confess. And I very much enjoyed the fact that he seemed to kind of relish throwing the grenade out there. You know?
I did, and, like, he doubled down. Like, that's the great thing about Scorsese. It's like, again, part of me, this is, like, part of my, you know, inherent sort of, I love a disruptor, or, you know, what you might call a troll in internet parlance, as long as the troll is intelligent, sophisticated, and shrewd. I'm not a big fan of "you suck" written on message boards, but I do quite like a bit of kind of performative, well, watch me shake this tree, because you have that happen where Scorsese, in that interview, is asked, what do you think of Marvel films? He's like, I don't think they're cinema. And everyone's like, whoa, you can't say that, man. And Scorsese's like, wait a minute. And he calls up the New York Times. He's like, hey, I'd like to write an editorial. I think I could do some good work here. And the headline is, you know, Marvel films are not cinema. The first line is, a little while ago, I caused a bit of controversy when I said that Marvel films weren't cinema. And you're like, oh, is he going to apologize? Is he going to backtrack? Is he going to, like, try and win people on side? He's like, I would like to explain exactly what I meant. And it's like, yeah. I kind of, like, I adore his doubling down on it, which is kind of, I admire it. As much as I don't agree with it, I kind of love the, I'm going to stick to my guns kind of aspect of it.
Yeah, well, even if you don't agree wholeheartedly, I thought that was a very, you know, well-written article, you know, and he talked about the productive tension of old Hollywood, and I think there was a lot to learn from what he said. And as I said earlier, I think, yeah, I've learned a lot from him. I just wanted to flag up quickly, if anybody hasn't seen he made a documentary with the BFI in the mid-90s called A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese for American Movies, which is 4 hours long, where he talks at length about all different types of director. You know, the director of Smuggler and all of these things. Shows a lot of great clips from a lot of great old movies. And just, I've always thought it's a wonderful educational tool. I'm not sure how well known it is. I had to get, like, a Dutch DVD to be able to see it. But if people can track that down, that would be fantastic. Darren, we established on our Batman episode that you and I did that you are Mr. IMDb. That's your villain name because of your work on the 250. Yeah, let's move quickly on to the Aviator. So what's your sense of where this film sort of stands in Scorsese's filmography? I mean, with particular reference to IMDb, like, do you know what it has got over there?
Well, I mean, to be honest, in terms of, like, Scorsese's filmography and The Aviator, like, personally, I really like The Aviator. I'm not sure it would be in my top 10 Scorsese kind of films, right, which are probably hideously cliche, right down to the inclusion of King of Comedy as the hipster. Well, hey, now we appreciate a choice. But I've always really liked The Aviator. I found it a very warm film. So it's probably somewhere in, like, my, you know, 10 to 15 when it comes to ranking Scorsese films. In terms of the IMDb, this is interesting because Scorsese is currently one of the most represented directors on the IMDb top 250 movies of all time. He is currently tied with three other artists kind of for that title. The first one is, sorry, two other artists for that title. Apologies, there was a purge, and Steven Spielberg has dropped down to six because Jaws dropped out of the list, which astounds me, but that's a separate conversation. So Martin Scorsese has seven films in the IMDb 250 at the moment, tying him with Stanley Kubrick and Christopher Nolan in terms of representation on the list. Akira Kurosawa has six, but at the moment, Throne of Blood is kind of coming in and out. That's currently around 250. So as you're listening to it, Kurosawa may also be kind of in that conversation, which is not a bad kind of list. And, you know, if you want to talk in terms of great filmmakers, it's also a very IMDb 250 list of great filmmakers, if we're being entirely honest. You know, the famous joke is that, you know, the golden age of anything is 12. And, you know, you could argue the golden age of kind of 30-year-old men voting on IMDb is the movies that they saw at the age of 12. So the IMDb movies that kind of have a preference are kind of Scorsese films, are kind of those films that are pretty much exactly what you would expect them to be. So I'm going to run through them very, very quickly. I don't think there'll be too many surprises for listeners there. So in terms of films that are listed on the 250 from Scorsese, Taxi Driver is the first one chronologically, which is entirely expected. Raging Bull is the next one, which is good. Then there's, after that, there's a gap until Goodfellas, which was released in 1990. One of the more interesting ones is Casino, which is obviously a film that had its own kind of reassessment. It's one of the rare Scorsese films that's undergone a reassessment after its release, but is genuinely accepted as kind of one of his best films ever. You could argue that the current process is that that's happening with King of Comedy at the moment, but it hasn't quite made it. Casino seems to be like, now we're like, what were we thinking in 1995 when we dismissed it? After Casino, then, there's a bit of a gap in terms of representation on the list, jumping forward to The Departed in 2006, skipping right over The Aviator, I'm afraid. Then from 2006 we go to 2010, the release of Shutter Island, and then Wolf of Wall Street is there as well. In terms of movies that have been on the list but dropped off, Hugo featured very, very briefly on the list on its release in December 2011, and The Irishman actually dropped off surprisingly quickly. It entered very high. It was the 61st best movie of all time, according to IMDb, when it entered the list in November last year, but it was gone by Christmas, which is kind of a really strange phenomenon where it just seemed to drop incredibly quickly. So that's kind of how Scorsese stands on IMDb.
Yeah, and well, The Irishman went from being like the awards favourite at one point, didn't it, to being completely passed over, like a true masterpiece, I think.
Well, at least it had that brief period where everybody liked it, so you're kind of assuming that at some point we'll all come around to getting back to it.
Yeah, I had IMDb open earlier. I tried to line up all of Scorsese's films top to bottom by IMDb rating. So The Aviator, if this list I've got here is accurate, is 19th of his feature films that he's directed, with a rating of 7.5. So I think that, I mean, my general thoughts on The Aviator is that this is a film I like. I think it's kind of a 3.5-star film from a man who's made many 5-star films. That's kind of how I'd characterize it. Now, I think there's a lot of pleasure to be had in the pleasurable surfaces of The Aviator. And I think what I mean there is kind of exemplified by, there's a moment in the film where we go from a shot of Leonardo DiCaprio's hand running across Cate Blanchett's back to him running his hand across the smooth airplane, you know, like the cut. So I think this is a very enjoyable film to luxuriate in, for instance, for the glamour on display, the costumes, the colour, the period recreations. Whilst I think there are some great things in this film, I think there are some elements that don't necessarily rise above being good. So I don't think all of the domestic strife works quite as well here as in some of his other films. Because I think of in some other Scorsese films, I'm kind of on the edge of my seat during, like, you know, comparable scenes. So I'm thinking of De Niro and Sharon Stone kind of going at it in Casino, for instance.
Yeah, or the domestic scenes in Raging Bull, even.
Or in Raging Bull, yep, definitely. And I never quite feel like that here. Now, if I'm sort of saying I'm chalking this one up as a minor disappointment, I think what you've got to say is I think there are a lot of filmmakers who've probably never made a film as good as The Aviator, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's unfortunately when you've made some of the greatest films ever made, perhaps you're judged a bit more harshly. I think someone like Spielberg, it's probably the same thing, you know, when he brings out new stuff these days. So I think if I think of something like Raging Bull, which you just mentioned, I mean, to describe that film as a great biopic seems almost too restrictive, too limiting. With The Aviator, that label, that kind of label seems a little bit more appropriate. It's perhaps not a film that's consistently as transcendent as something like Raging Bull. But yeah, what say you? What do you reckon?
Yeah, this is the thing with The Aviator, where I would probably be a bit kinder. I'd probably give it a 4-star film from a 5-star yeah. filmmaker. But again, I think that the same issues kind of come into play there. And I think that for me, it's not quite that the kind of like the domestic scenes kind of lack friction. Because I think that, you know, I'm probably a bit kinder there. I think I see what Scorsese's doing with the film. And again, it's all in that wonderful cut that you mentioned, the kind of the cut of the hand moving down kind of Catherine Hepburn's yeah. back and then cutting to the plane. Because it's a very tactile film. It's a film about, and again, you know, when I joked at the start, this is a film about isolation and quarantine. And it absolutely is, because it, like, the opening scene establishes that. But it's also very much a film about emotional isolation, about being cut off and disconnected. And I kind of, that stuff really landed with me this time. It's probably a result of, you know, the times that we live in and looking at it through that prism. But I think that, you know, as Scorsese films go, Scorsese is a director who is very interested in this theme of kind of like the self and kind of cutting yourself off and the connections that you have to other people. He very famously wanted to become a priest, and he yeah. didn't. And the reason why he didn't, he gave two reasons. The first one was that he felt that he should, if he wanted to, that vocation, he should choose it for the greater good, not because it served his own interests. And so him wanting to be a priest disqualified him from being a priest, which is an interesting approach to take. But the other angle that he took is that as a kid who had asthma, and yeah. had breathing difficulties, he couldn't play sports, and he had difficulty interacting with kids his own age and connecting with kids his own age. And he always felt kind of cut off and isolated from them as well. And so, you know, he didn't want to become a priest because he saw that path, that vocation, being very isolating from his fellow man, being something that kind of cut him off. And you can see it throughout Scorsese's filmography, these stories of people who cut themselves off physically, who cut themselves off emotionally, most crucially. You know, the classic Scorsese study of masculinity is a man who cannot connect with other people because he will not let himself do that. And I actually think The Aviator is one of the better films in Scorsese's filmography, because obviously the subject matter lends itself to that, where you have Howard Hughes kind of cutting himself off from the world around him, putting himself in literal self-quarantine, but, you know, not just emotionally but physically. So I actually really like the kind of that coldness that you mentioned, the kind of the lack of friction in the domestic scenes, because it feels like a result of that isolation. For me, the problem is, and again, this feels ironic as somebody who's like, yeah, I love The Irishman, it was my favorite film of last year, it's a sense of pacing and kind of length. And I think that, you know, The Aviator is a film of two halves, and I think that I find the first half, which is much more focused on Hughes' personal life and his mm-hmm. relationship with Hepburn, his relationship with other women, and his relation, kind of like the beginnings of kind of the psychosis that would come to consume him, I find that much more interesting than the second half, which is a film that is much more about kind of conventional, you know, obsession, and kind of, you know, is the part of the film that just begs you, like, you're staring at it and it's staring at you and it's going, go on, just do it. And you're like, okay, fine. This is a metaphor for how difficult it is to realize your vision as an artist. And it's like, yeah. And it's like, you know, that stuff is great. I think it's really well constructed. I think Scorsese has a wonderful eye, and there's a lot of passion underscoring it. And it's a good movie. But for me, that second half feels disconnected from the first. They don't really tie together in the way that, like, Scorsese's best long films do. Where, again, The Irishman, which is a longer film, but somehow feels shorter, manages to work because it ties all of that together with that powerhouse final 45 minutes, which are, you know, one of the best endings mm-hmm. I've seen in film, you know, and it's almost as long as a film itself, you could argue. But because it feels like a logical flow from where you've been, what you've gone through, to where you are. And The Aviator, for me, suffers a little bit because it doesn't have that clear a bridge between its two extremes. You can see the threads connecting. And again, you logically have this kind of sequence in the second half where he comes out of quarantine, where he connects with Ava, and he kind of brings himself and forces himself out into the world. And that kind of allows him to come together and to kind of to triumph. but at the same time, it feels like the film pivots a little bit too sharply. It starts being about something else about an hour and a half into the runtime, which is something that in a long film you have to do very carefully, and I'm not sure The Aviator, for me at least, does that carefully enough.
Yeah, I mean, again, if I'm talking about a lack, it's a relative lack. Like I say, it's still a film I find a lot of, you know, derive a lot of pleasure from. And I think the sort of bridges between different sections that you speak of there, I mean, sometimes that's explicitly kind of announced, isn't it? I'm thinking of like the shift in color palette at a certain point, for instance.
And the title cards, they give you like times and location stamps. So it's like, oh, we're doing this now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we can return to a lot of these issues, but I just wanted to start on a more sort of brass tacks point, really. So it's interesting, I think, because this is a project Scorsese inherited. The Aviator had been developed by Michael Mann for and with Leonardo DiCaprio for a period of about 2 or 3 years before, I think, Mann was coming off of The Insider and Ali, and he sort of opted to steer clear of another film with like historical subject matter. I think this was about the time he made Collateral, if I'm not mistaken. So then Scorsese came on board. So it probably made for a nice change of pace for him after Gangs of New York, which is kind of a famously troubled production and clashes with Harvey Weinstein, all these things. So this was, I think, quite a big budget film, around $115 million. It had been turned down by all the studios. It ultimately was made because of the backing of independent producer Graham King. So if we're saying this is a film that he kind of, you know, he didn't originate this material necessarily, and somebody else was shepherding it for a long time, it still feels like quite a good fit for Scorsese to me.
It does indeed. Well, I mean, this is one of the things where you have that kind of, we mentioned like part of what the appeal of Scorsese is, that flexibility, that ability to exist in two worlds at kind of one time, where you can be this director who has this strong artistic vision, but you also have this ability to be accessible and to be kind of welcoming and to be kind of, you know, inclusive. And it's notable as well that you mentioned this beginning as a Mann film. When this picked up a Best Picture nomination, Scorsese didn't get a Best Picture nomination for it. He wasn't listed on there. It was Michael Mann who was listed on the Best Picture nominees for this film. And again, there's a sense of, I think it was actually DiCaprio who was responsible for getting Scorsese involved in this, which is again kind of interesting, because it gets at that relationship that you have between, you know, Scorsese and DiCaprio, because you've again, when you talk about Scorsese's filmography, you have these two great artistic muses that he's had in terms of his feature film production. Robert De Niro, obviously, you know, we mentioned films like, you know, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, you know, going back to Mean Streets, or even back to his earliest films as well. But you have this kind of sense of, you know, this muse that existed. And then, you know, sort of Scorsese kind of then becoming partnering with Leonardo DiCaprio. And obviously Gangs of New York was kind of a big moment for them in terms of coming together. And this is as well, because there's a sense of kind of, you know, of basically DiCaprio saying, yeah, this film I'm working on, I know the right guy for it, and the right guy for it is kind of Martin Scorsese. And you have this sense with DiCaprio where, you know, in the 90s, he was coming off this sense of being a young heartthrob, a kind of a teen actor. And again, one of the things that I think is central to DiCaprio's appeal as an actor, what makes him a really great performer to watch, is that kind of star persona where All DiCaprio's work has this kind of desperation to it. And it's a strange thing to talk about desperation when you're talking about one of the most handsome men in the world, who is one of the last movie stars in existence, who is one of the rare actors who can get like a high budget, adult oriented film kind of released in cinemas and have it make a profit. So it's kind of strange to talk about a man like that and say, yeah, but all his films seem so desperate. But there is this sense of desperation that runs through like the best of his performances. And I'm thinking in particular, say, most recently, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where Tarantino uses DiCaprio's desperation in contrast to Brad Pitt's, well, I'm here and that's good enough, kind of like casual, cool, I'm super relaxed, to create a contrast between the two. Christopher Nolan, 2010 with Inception, where that movie is driven by, again, DiCaprio's kind of frantic, kind of like, kind of desperation and kind of urge and kind of like drive to accomplish what he's doing. And whenever you're watching DiCaprio, there's this wonderful intensity. And again, I'm worried about seeming like I'm psychoanalyzing him. I don't think I am. But where there's a sense of like, take me seriously as an actor, that kind of comes from a place of beginning as a teen heartthrob, breaking out as a teen heartthrob. And again, a sense of rebelling against that, you know, where you have in the 90s, you have him kind of skewering his celebrity persona in Celebrity with Woody Allen, for example. But what you have is, even coming into the new millennium after the success of Titanic, you have DiCaprio completing what has been described as his greatest living director bingo card, where it's like, yeah, I want to work with Tarantino, I want to work with Ridley Scott, I want to work with Scorsese, I want to work with Spielberg, and basically just rhyming all these kind of directors off and kind of trusting them to basically give him material that he can use, where he can be kind of taken seriously as an actor. And again, I think that works really well here. But again, it's remarkable in the sense of him latching on to Scorsese as a director that he trusts incredibly. And again, I would argue that, you know, as much as I love Inception, and, you know, as much as he won the Oscar for The Revenant, I don't think DiCaprio has found a director with whom he has an easier rapport than with Scorsese. And I think the two understand each other very, very well. And I think that it's kind of interesting that, you know, you look at the development history of The Aviator, and, you know, arguably not even just the development history of The Aviator. You have this long history of, and again, it's because Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood. Hollywood loves making movies that kind of glamorize it and kind of nostalgically look back at its own past. And again, you point to, like, Best Picture winners like Argo, you know, as an example of this, or The Artist as an example of this. But, like, there's a sense of, like, everybody in Hollywood at one point or another wanting to make a Howard Hughes biopic. You have, like, Christopher Nolan's one that he was working on with Jim Carrey briefly. You have Milos Forman, who was working on around about 2000 with Edward Norton. And you can kind of almost see that in certain segments of The Aviator, where DiCaprio is kind of working on his kind of, you know, repetition, where he's kind of repeating these mantras to himself. And you can almost see that, like, in 2000, you could do that with Edward Norton. And I find it kind of amazing that, like, the one director who ended up actually making the Howard Hughes biopic of the 21st century was the one director who actually didn't seem that keenly attached to it, who, like, was just almost kind of brought in by chance or by accident to work on it. And I think that while that's true and while that's the case, it's to Scorsese's credit that it feels like a Scorsese film. It, and again, you know, we've alluded to how it feels like a Scorsese film. It has those themes of isolation, those themes of kind of remove. And there's so much that runs through it, the way in which his camera looks at, like, touching and contact and hands, the motif of hands. Mm-hmm. You have the sequence of, you know, like, the sequence where Howard Hughes is kind of projecting film onto his hands, the sequence in which he's holding Gene's hand during the premiere, the way in which his first real OCD kind of germophobic attack comes when he's watching Katharine Hepburn being manhandled by Louis C. Meyer, for example. Louis B. Meyer, apologies. But you have this kind of sense of how important touch is, obviously, which is important in the sense of making a movie about Howard Hughes, who was a famous germaphobe, but in terms of being a film that's about contact and about communion and about touching and about obsession. And then even in the second half, you have, like, which I mentioned earlier, is kind of feeling somewhat disconnected from it, but you have this kind of theme of, you know, great vision. And this theme of kind of, like, spending money and not getting a return on money. And this idea of kind of, like, a project into which you sunk your passion and your heart, in which you've invested, you know, countless millions of dollars, you know, of money that isn't technically yours, but you haven't managed to deliver a product that is up to specifications for it. And while in the context of the film, that's like, well, you didn't build these planes that you said you would for the US people, you know, in the sense of this being a Scorsese film, this being a film about a director who has, you know, we've mentioned managed to stay profitable, managed to stay on budget. Despite all that, you know, has had his share of embarrassments, but has watched his colleagues kind of struggle with overrunning budgets and failing to earn return from studios. And again, you have this sense of kind of that maybe being as something that kind of touches kind of what Scorsese was kind of feeling or thinking about that moment. You mentioned this came right off the back of Gangs of New York, which was Scorsese's passion project. You know, they talk about the white elephant. Can a white elephant fly when they're driving the Hercules down the road? Like, watching the release of Gangs of New York, which was a passion project for Scorsese, something he had wanted to make for decades, something that he planned to do with Robert De Niro, it was that old, and finally managed to kind of realize that. And then watching it, you know, A, garner some of the weakest reviews of his career to that point, B, become embroiled, as you mentioned, in that argument that happened with Harvey Weinstein and kind of the cutting and the editing of it as well. And then, you know, D, that the financial returns on it, which were maybe not what everybody expected it to be. You almost get a sense of watching that play out in the second half of The Aviator. And I mean, it's notable that even in the context of The Aviator, when Hughes is kind of confronted by the sort of subcommittee with that, with the fact that he spent other people's money and he didn't get a return on investment, his response to that is, yeah, but I also put in my own money because I believed in it so much. Mm-hmm. It's notable that Scorsese himself has argued that with The Aviator, which is a film that also went over budget, you mentioned it had a very large budget for what it was doing, particularly for a filmmaker coming off a somewhat troubled production that had maybe not earned as much at the box office as people would have hoped. Scorsese apparently put some of his own money in the film to make up that difference between his projected budget and what the film actually costs as well. So there's a real sense of this, to a certain extent, feeling like Scorsese dealing with some of that, working through some of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't think it's hard to see why Howard Hughes would appeal to him as a protagonist, you know, someone powerful who's held back because he can't escape from his own flaws, can't escape from himself. As you already said, somebody who was drawn to excess, somebody who pushed the boundaries. And yeah, it's not, I think you also mentioned that Scorsese had grown up as quite a sickly child. I think it's also his brother, I believe, had polio before Scorsese himself was born. So I'm sure he could have empathized with Hughes's kind of sheltered childhood. What he says, I saw an interview where he said that he was fascinated by this character that John Logan had written, not least because he was someone you couldn't interpret in a simple, straightforward way. And that seems very Scorsese to me. Like, one thing I've always appreciated about his films is that, I don't know, you can find a core of humanity in people who are otherwise very reprehensible, I think, in a lot of his films. What he says is that the screenplay for this film reminded him of the way Paul Schrader structured the screenplay for Raging Bull. It offered an original perspective on Hughes' life. And it means we never fully see the Howard Hughes a popular memory, doesn't it? It means, yeah, we never see him hold up in Las Vegas, for instance, which is definitely an interesting choice. What Scorsese says is that he kept thinking about this a lot during the production, kept talking about it with people. But when he saw the dailies from the sequence with Hughes in the screening room, his mind was settled. Like, look, there's no need to show Howard as an old man. You know, there he is, yeah, kind of thing. And like I say, definitely a striking choice. What do you make of that? Do you have any qualms about that?
This is kind of interesting that you should kind of mention that, because I think that you're entirely right in terms of Scorsese being a director who doesn't shy away from warts and all. I mean, you know, Raging Bull is one of the greatest movies ever made. And you're quite right that, like, describing it as a biopic almost feels kind of, you know, like it minimizes what that film accomplishes, but it very much does capture this sense of a person who is at their lowest ebb and is maybe not a good person in inverted commas, but is still deserving of our sympathy and our empathy to a certain extent. I think that what I find interesting about The Aviator is that despite, you know, the point of comparison that, you know, that that he makes there to the Paul Schrader work, is that The Aviator, while I'm hesitant to use the word sanitized because I think it does actually cover some of Hughes's excesses. And, you know, it's not always the most flattering of portrayals. And it's quite candid about some of his failings. I do think that it obscures some of the most controversial or some of the worst aspects, or kind of glides over some of the aspects of Hughes's personality and his history that maybe, you know, would render him less sympathetic to audiences if they were rendered on film. I don't quite see this, you know, and again, who am I to talk to Martin Scorsese about how he sees his film? But I don't see the script in the same way as a companion to kind of Raging Bull or anything like that. I don't see it as that kind of grimy study of masculinity that you would expect with something like Taxi Driver. I think that element is there. I just don't think it's brought up in the mix. And it's kind of interesting to hear Scorsese talk about it in a way that suggests maybe he thought it was. Because I think that the movie is quite kind to use, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that I think he also said that when he read this screenplay, Scorsese said he sort of remembered hearing news of Hughes' aviation exploits on the radio as a child. And then he was kind of surprised, like 15 pages into this screenplay, he kind of realized what story it was telling. And you're right, there were other aspects of Hughes' life. Like, we don't get to the point where he's kind of running RKO and he's just absolutely this controlling figure of all these women he's got on contract and so on and so forth.
Or like the car accident that killed the pedestrian, Gabriel S. Mayer, and stuff like that as well. Yeah.
It glosses over the full extent of his womanizing, I think, as well. And those are some of the criticisms I've heard about the film, that there are certain omissions and simplifications. Also seen it suggested that it plays up his OCD in a manner that's chronologically a bit unjustified. It's a very interesting topic, I think, like how mindful we should be of such historical revisionism. And I think one of the criticisms we could make about mainstream biopics in general, perhaps, is that they contribute to a skewed sort of sense of history from above, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, the idea that history is shaped by all these significant people, the kings and queens, presidents, prime ministers, etc.
And the fact that a person, you know, the basic idea of this kind of biopic, and I know that you're entirely right that it avoids the kind of later years in Las Vegas, but the sense that you can sum up an entire life in even 3 hours is kind of always going to seem, you know, a bit of an oversimplification.
Yeah, I think so. I think to fully understand the importance or, you know, to fully understand a notable figure's life, you need to map out their whole life rather than focusing on one particular moment in time or a limited period of time. But I think the best medium to do that is probably biographical writing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Narrative filmmaking is not perhaps the best medium to provide that kind of focus, but films can do other things exceptionally well. Films are arguably better than any other medium at compressing and juxtaposing things. So I think I can understand the lament in some quarters about what we don't get in The Aviator. But what I was going to say about the biopic, I think the issue often is that this focus on an individual can get in the way of a true understanding of the past, can't it? Because
yeah.
You often get a situation where a character kind of conquering a personal problem becomes this kind of proxy through which, you know, broader issues are complicated or resolved. So I think of a film like The King's Speech, where the implication seems to be that George VI's ability to overcome his speech impediment was very important in helping to reassure the British nation, you know, the British public at the outset of the war. And I don't know, I think such narratives can be important and comforting, but I think as an across-the-board thing, it can be a bit regrettable.
Yeah.
Now, The Aviator is a very interesting film in that regard. I mean, how do you see it sort of stacking up with more traditional biopic narratives, like I've sort of alluded to there?
I think actually, to be fair to The Aviator, I think it kind of succeeds because it does almost the opposite, where it kind of reduces down, it kind of shrinks down so that, like, these little struggles that Howard Hughes is having, and again, he frames them in terms of kind of like huge idealistic battles. So, you know, it's like, you know, Pan Am doesn't control the sky, for example. You know, these sort of like big, vague philosophical kind of statements about what he's fighting for and why he's fighting for it. But the film kind of avoids kind of falling into some of the more, what you might call kind of heavy-handed literalism of biopics. Like, it's notable that there's no closing coded text that explains to you how Howard Hughes died, or tells you very simply what Howard Hughes' legacy was in three sentences, which is somehow even more reductive than, like, trying to compress it down to 2 hours. And so it has this effect of kind of making Howard Hughes' story. And again, this is why I think it works very well. I'm arguably more fond of the kind of shorter, tighter, focused biopics that we've gotten in the past 20 years that tend to focus on a particular event and
you
treat
mean like
those
Lincoln, something like that, or
something like that. But even going back to things like, say, The Queen, for example,
or The Deal,
or even like Frost Nixon, where you have these kind of like pinpoint focus, kind of accuracy, kind of like, you know, historical films that are like, here's a single event, or even Rush, for example. But what we're going to do is, through that prism of this event, we're going to look at the character of these historical figures. And kind of, we're going to hope that maybe in this kind of narrow focus, we can illuminate character. Because I think that, yeah, you're entirely right that, like, biographical works, like long form writing, is probably the best place to try and capture an entire life in prose, in a medium that isn't actually living. But mm-hmm. I think that, like, with, you know, film, it works better in kind of like a tighter, compressed kind of focus. And I think that why The Aviator gets away with this, with kind of that broader approach, better than a lot of other biographical films, is because it kind of makes it almost allegorical. It doesn't, you know, you mentioned that OCD and kind of the exaggeration of his OCD and the fact that maybe doesn't line up with the historical record, the historical fact. And even when I was, you know, talking about how it kind of glosses over some of the more complicated legacies mm-hmm. of Hughes and his history, I think the film gets a pass from me, at least, for a lot of that, because it feels like it's a broader story that just happens to be using a historical figure, it never feels like it's demanding to be taken very seriously or very literally or very studiously, which is ironic. Like, again, you compare it to something like JFK, which is, you know, arguably even more historical fiction, but which is structured and told in such a way that, you know, Stone seems to be saying, see, I told you this is exactly what happened. You watch The Aviator, and particularly due to choices, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment in terms of, you know, the technique that was used, the colouring and the shading, and even like things as small as the shifting of the aspect ratio or the use of kind of voiceover from newsreel footage, kind of contributes to a sense that you are, you know, watching something that is filtered through a prism rather than presenting reality. And again, you have that kind of discussion at the Hepburn home where, you know, Hepburn's mother says, you know, oh, we're all expressionists now. I mean, why would you paint something real when you can just take a photo? And even like that discussion that Hepburn has where, you know, she's like, movies are movies. They're not real life. So you have this sense of like almost Scorsese almost rising to the challenge of Hepburn's mother and filming something that isn't capturing real life per se, but is instead kind of more expressionist in terms of how it's approaching. It's more stylized. And I think that aspect of the film allows me to kind of excuse or get away with the way in which it kind of obscures or writes around the real history, because it doesn't, it's obviously a Howard Hughes biopic, but it feels like it's as much a Scorsese film or as much a parable or as much a kind of an allegory as it is any of those things. It's a story about, you know, again, that cliche of it's a story about a man trying to realize his vision, which could just as easily apply to the man behind the camera as the character in front of it.
Yeah, and also one of the things that came to mind when you were speaking there was like when Katharine Hepburn turns up and talks exactly like a Katharine Hepburn character in a film would, you know, the kind of screwball kind of patter as well.
Oh yeah, because Scorsese actually directed those scenes like screwball comedies. He instructed sort of Hepburn and he instructed DiCaprio to play them as kind of screwball comedies that would have been produced at the same time. So it's, and this is the thing we mentioned at the start, where for Scorsese, you know, form and function kind of interlink, where it's like what he's doing is inseparable from how he's doing it, but not in a way that is kind of showy. I mean, I picked up that the dialogue was stylized and heightened in the way they had the Cate Blanchett love it, hate it performance here, you know, the Oscar winning love it, hate it performance here, which I kind of adore because I think it's meant to be heightened and stylized and cartoonish to an extent. I think it's meant to be, you know, it's notable that like Scorsese directed her to watch Hepburn's films so that she could perform her in real life, which is interesting. And I think that Blanchett notoriously avoided reading biographies and instead read her memoirs because she didn't want to filter through anybody else's version of who Katharine Hepburn was rather than kind of just processing how Hepburn presented herself, which kind of, again, gives that layer of that sense of like wanting to avoid objectivity and just kind of embracing a kind of a stylized approach to it all.
Mm. And apparently the first day that Blanchett turned up on set was the day Katharine Hepburn died, which is just one of those really weird kind of things, you know?
Yeah.
Just on The Aviator as a biopic, it's interesting. It comes at a time when it seems like there'd been a bit of a shift in emphasis in biopics on many occasions towards lesser known historical figures. So I'm thinking of things like Catch Me If You Can to extend the DiCaprio comparison, which is, just a couple of years ago, isn't it, at this point?
Yeah.
George Clooney's film Confessions of a Dangerous Mind would be another example. So ostensibly, what The Aviator is offering you is a more sturdy, familiar type of story in that respect. And it ostensibly seems to open with a traditional Hollywood device, doesn't it? So I'm talking about the tableau with the mother.
Yeah, the sort of like Nixon-esque, it reminds me a lot of the sequence from Nixon by Oliver Stone, speaking of Oliver Stone historical films, which has a similar sort of sequence, which is like, here is the character's psychology explained to you through childhood trauma.
Yeah, cause and effect kind of thing. Yeah. But there's something so kind of artificial and theatrical about the way it's presented to us in The Aviator that I think it kind of retains its air of mystery. So I saw somebody compare it to the use of Rosebud in Citizen Kane. You know, something that doesn't necessarily tell you as much as you might think. And I think that, some of the other biopic elements, like the sort of traditional biopic elements, they're handled in a more sophisticated manner than you might expect. So I'm thinking about the fact that this is a film, it's a film about Howard Hughes, it's a film called The Aviator, but when we hear about his round-the-world flight here, it's just kind of tossed off, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like we get a bit of newsreel footage, we get a map on the screen, and that's about it. It's not really given the prominent narrative focus you might expect. You know, you can imagine that sort of being its own narrative of feature film length in its own right. So I think that's a very interesting choice.
And the great detail about that is that, like, the most important thing he does during that sequence is buy stock.
Yeah. So yeah, okay, I wanted to circle back to DiCaprio, because I know you talked a bit about him there earlier, but we went back to talk about Scorsese afterwards, I think. So yeah, his second film with Scorsese after Gangs of New York, and I think it's very interesting casting, because, and you've kind of already brought this up, but there's this kind of correspondence between DiCaprio and Hughes in some respects, you know, the celebrity status, the play-by image. Also, this correspondence with some of DiCaprio's earlier roles, where it kind of taps into his matinee idol appeal. But to be fair to him, he'd already demonstrated that he was skilled at sort of conveying mental impairment, I guess, because I think he was Oscar-nominated, wasn't he, for What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Gilbert Grape, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting performance. I mean, to what extent do you think he gets under the skin of Howard Hughes? I think it's a good performance. I think it's certainly a step up from his work on Gangs of New York, perhaps not as strong as some of his late performances for Scorsese. Like, I think The Wolf of Wall Street was a perfect fit.
Or Shutter Island, even.
And Shutter Island, yeah.
Like, the kind of that pathology, that sort of, like, really intense kind of coming apart under pressure kind of approach.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I've always thought of DiCaprio as an actor who's very kind of gestural. And what I mean by that is when I close my eyes and I think of DiCaprio acting, I always seem to see him jabbing his index finger, you know. But he's also someone who seems very in control to me. So I think he's very compelling here, isn't he, as someone who's struggling to keep a lid on things. I'm thinking of like the times in the film where he sort of suddenly clasps his hands to his mouth when he can't stop repeating words, for instance. Yeah, so what aspects of his performance did you most appreciate?
And again, like, this is the thing where I mentioned the kind of Milos Forman and Edward Norton one, and you can imagine the kind of Edward Norton-style primal fear version of this movie. And it's quite different from what DiCaprio gives you, where there is this intensity of focus. But it always feels like, and again, it's that kind of, like, thin line where you have the sense of him being tightly wound and him being, like, on the verge of exploding. And again, this portrayal of kind of OCD and the idea that, and again, this is one of the things where I'm kind of wary about, you know, the portrayal of kind of mental illness on film, mm-hmm. and kind of the question you mentioned, kind of you alluded to the fact that, you know, some of the chronology may not be entirely right with the portrayal of OCD. And to be fair to DiCaprio and Scorsese, they did actually work with psychologists in terms of like getting the portrayal right and trying not to sensationalize it or portray it as kind of in a way that's exaggerated. But I think that one of the things that works with the kind of allegorical quality of the film is that it often seems like he's so tightly wound that he is about to implode completely. And DiCaprio is one of those rare actors who can do that, who can pivot between those extremes of, I am the brightest guy in the room. I'm the center of attention. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy who you're listening to. You can honestly, as an audience, believe that people would give me large amounts of money to just stand there and talk. And I mean, that's the entire premise of The Wolf of Wall Street. But like, you also have that other kind of flip side of his performances, which are, you can also believe me as somebody who is just one bad day away from completely collapsing into myself and ending up a nervous wreck lying on the ground. And again, films like The Departed kind of play to that as well. And I think that what works really well in The Aviator is that you get those two extremes. And I'm thinking of the example with, is it Bob Gross, where he's kind of like, you know, where he's like, oh, I want to buy the first 40 planes that come off your conveyor belt line and give me, like, that will give me a 2-year kind of exclusive on them. And it begins with this big spiel, you know, where he's selling them on and he's buying them and, you know, back and forth banter. And you can see why Hughes is so, you know, able to get so far and is so compelling. But then you just have the little fleck of kind of dirt on Gross's lapel. And you can see in that scene DiCaprio almost kind of pivoting. And again, the way in which Scorsese shoots it, where he's holding kind of over, you know, on DiCaprio, he's not giving you an insert shot of the dirt, even though you can see the dirt in the corner of the frame. He's mm-hmm. just trusting DiCaprio to kind of pivot within the scene and get from that performance of, well, aren't I great? I'm the man who can manage millions and millions of dollars, to, well, now I'm unraveling right in front of your eyes. And again, I think that's something that speaks to the way in which Scorsese and DiCaprio kind of play off one another, kind of understand one another and get some of the best out of one another of their output. And I think that DiCaprio is very, very good here. And I think you're entirely right that it moves on that pivot from that kind of matinee idol sort of thing where you have the celebrity and he's out with the young women and he's the subject of gossip and kind of mongering mm-hmm. and kind of like subject to all those flashbulbs going off in his face. And at the same time, then also wanting to be somebody who is taken seriously at what he does, which again is a large part of kind of DiCaprio's kind of arc, you know, and I mentioned there trying to pivot from being a teen idol to a serious actor, but also mm-hmm. even like the famous Leonardo DiCaprio Oscar kind of snubbing, you know, allegations yeah. that went around. And again, The Aviator is one of the, I think it's one of the first examples of that, because it was, he got a nomination, one of the film's 11 nominations and five wins, but he got mm-hmm. one, he got a nomination for Best Actor for his work here. He didn't win. And it kind of becomes this kind of like, I think this is where the snowball really starts to build, where people start noticing that DiCaprio is very, very committed to getting a Best Actor Oscar, for getting a statuette that, you know, perhaps if one were being cynical, he could use to say, I am a serious actor. I'm no longer just Jack from Titanic. I'm no longer just a teen heartthrob. I'm somebody who is among the very best people at what I'm doing. And the idea that, like, DiCaprio's, you know, almost laser-guided focus on this, which is paralleled only with, ironically enough, his Titanic co-star Kate Winslet as well, had a similar sort of campaign going on. Yeah. She got there first with Revolutionary Road. Did she win for Revolutionary Road? Oh, she won for The Reader. She won for The Reader.
The Reader, yeah.
Yes. And again, the two of them starred together in Revolutionary Road, which was very much a give-us-both-Oscars movie. And you have that, like, throughout his career, where you have DiCaprio's kind of star persona. And again, coming back to the star persona, because again, you know, DiCaprio described, was it Entertainment Weekly, called him the last movie star, which, you know, kind of cements this idea that he is a movie star. And a large part of what a movie star is, what distinguishes a movie star, I would argue, from a more conventional actor, is that a star has a persona, and that so much of their work plays off that persona and the audience's understanding of their persona. Yep. And DiCaprio's persona is defined by that sense of desperation. If you read Vulture, for example, you could argue that that desperation is that weird obsession that he had with Rihanna for a couple of years, or that weird summer where he seemed to be very into playing volleyball with 20-year-old people in order to show that he was as athletic as he ever was. But if you want to be more academic and more kind of, you know, a cinephile about it, you could say that it's reflected in his, like, single-minded pursuit of the Oscar, which led to things like The Revenant, where, you know, he was sitting out in the middle of, like, this freezing weather, eating raw bison liver and almost like on the verge of death. And there's a sense in which when he finally got that Best Actor Oscar, it was almost like the Academy was saying, look, if we don't give it to him, he's going to kill himself trying to earn it. And again, there's that intensity that you associate with DiCaprio and his best performances, and that desire to be taken seriously. And you can see that here in the way that he plays Hughes, where Hughes, like, is a man who, no matter what he's doing, wants to be taken seriously doing it. That introductory scene on the set of Hell's Angels kind of lays it out, where he's like, I don't want them to call me Junior. I'm Mr. Hughes. That's my name, you know? Or like, you know, the demands that he places on people to be perfect around him. You could argue even like his cleanliness is an expression of that, just taken to the greatest possible degree. And even like the scene with Hepburn's family, where he refuses to be talked down to, where instead of engaging or arguing at the table, he just kind of demands their attention and kind of storms out because they refuse to give him the sense, to make him the center of attention in their kind of arguments or discussions. And like, you have that sense with Hughes of it being a role that is almost perfectly tailored to what DiCaprio is capable of doing at that point in his career. And I think you were entirely right, by the way, and you say that it's better than, you know, Gangs of New York. I think he's quite good in Gangs of New York, but I think that's a role that doesn't play to his strengths. Most obviously, the accent is perhaps mm-hmm. the most literal example of that. But even like Costigan as a character the movie seems to want Costigan to be a more conventional leading man than I think DiCaprio is capable of. I think The Aviator much more keenly kind of spots the sweet spot with a good DiCaprio performance, which is he can be incredibly charming. He has the looks of kind of a matinee idol, but he also at the same time has this kind of drive and this yearn that, you know, isn't necessarily what you would expect from somebody that handsome, that rich, and that successful.
Yeah. Well, just to mention a few other particular moments that I don't think you brought up there, but yeah, you sort of see his personal magnetism on display. There's this very interesting scene early on where he gets very interested in one of the waitresses at the Coconut Grove, and it kind of feels like he's shining this spotlight on her. But also, what I really enjoy about this performance is some of the other times, things like when Errol Flynn takes his pee off his plate, you know, or when he's staring at the bathroom doorknob. And Scorsese decided not to do these. I think there had been some consideration of doing some visual things with, you know, CGI germs or whatever at certain points of the film. And I'm glad they didn't decide to go that way. I think, you know, DiCaprio can suggest with a look just how troubling he finds things like that. in a way that's more than effective enough. Just the other thing I wanted to mention on a trivia point was that last night I was watching Rules Don't Apply, which is the Warren Beatty, Howard Hughes. Have you seen that film?
I have not, but again, you reminded me of the fact that Warren Beatty was also trying to make a Howard Hughes film.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I only got an hour in, and it's not because of anything to do with the film. I was just very tired last night, and I was hoping to watch it before we spoke today. I just didn't get the chance. But very interesting that DiCaprio is 30 when he makes The Aviator. And you think of those scenes in the film with, you know, the Alan Alda character, the hearings. We also see those hearings on screen in Rules Don't Apply, with Warren Beatty as an 80-year-old playing Howard Hughes. So just, I can't think of any comparable example where two actors 50 years apart in age have played the same figure at the same point in time. Very interesting. Just on Hughes again, I mean, we've talked a bit about how Scorsese's made these comparisons with the screenplay to Raging Bull, and you're saying, you know, you think perhaps that's a little bit of a stretch, it sounds like. And I think there is a sense, though, that this character is in conversation with some of those other Scorsese protagonists, even if it's not as exacting a character study, you know. Yeah. There's some Christ-like imagery in the film. Now, Scorsese says it's not intentional, but I'm thinking of the scene in the screening room, for instance.
With the desert, you know, there's no germs in the desert. It's hot, but there's no germs. The sense that he has to go out and find himself, yeah.
Yeah, the projector light forms kind of a halo behind him as well, is what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But also the scene of Katharine Hepburn washing Howard Hughes' feet, for example.
Yeah.
You know, like somebody like Charlie in Mean Streets, you know, we go through this ritual of fire where Hughes burns all his clothes in Mean Streets. Charlie was always holding his finger to the flame and so on. You mentioned the perfectionism, and it made me think of Casino, because there's a scene in Casino where Robert De Niro insists that the blueberries and the blueberry muffins must be exactly spaced apart.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what Hughes asks for at one point in this film, but he gives some kind of
it's
food
the cookies.
Order. Yeah,
it's 10 cookies, but he wants the chips properly kind of allocated and not too near the edges.
Yeah, so I was thinking that you know, we can see these parallels with other Scorsese characters. I think I also agree with what you were saying earlier that, you know, perhaps we shouldn't try to take them too far. In fact, that sounds like what you were saying earlier anyway.
Well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, he is very much a Scorsese character. And again, one of the things that I think works very well, I mentioned that the movie being kind of allegorical. And I think that you're entirely right in terms of like spotting those parallels with, you know, the halo in the screening room, or the kind of the obsession with the desert, going out into the desert and finding himself, even if the desert just happens to be a desert on screen rather than an actual desert, which somehow manages to be both Jesus Christ and possibly Martin Scorsese at the same time. But we're not going to read too much into that. But I mean, even things like the way in which the film kind of is again, I mentioned the allegory at the heart of it, but the idea that that sense of kind of yearning and isolation and connection, which runs through so much of Scorsese's filmography, but I can't remember it being ever as kind of close to the surface as it is here, where you have this idea that as much as the movie, you know, is about Howard Hughes and kind of draws on history and is inspired by real events and kind of is kind of this love letter to the history of cinema, as well as kind of like looking at this kind of metaphor for movie making as well, it's also very much a story about stuff like physical contact. And you mentioned that sequence, you mentioned a couple of those sequences, like where Errol Flynn, played by Jude Law, picks the pee off his plate, for example.
Yeah.
But this sense of, you know, The Aviator almost being about sublimation. About you know, sort of like being about what it's not literally about, what it's actually about, where you have the paralleling of the opening scene where the mother, you know, talks about quarantine and has him spell it out, Q-U-A-R. Mm-hmm. But then you have the discussion kind of later on where his press agent Mayer is talking about the filming of The Outlaw, and it's about S-E-X, for example. But you have even that sequence that you mentioned where he's, you know, touching Kate Blanchett's back, and you have that wonderful cut. It's a fantastic cut of his hand moving down her back, cutting to the hand kind of moving down her, you know, the surface of the plane, for example. You have the sequence where, you know, when Louis B. Mayer is kind of touching Hepburn all over, you cut to Howard's hand, which is just kind of rubbing against his pants, for example. You have the kind of the red meat at the family dinner. You have this idea of, you know, the obsession that he has with Jane Russell's breasts, but not in a way that is portrayed as kind of explicit or lurid or purient, to quote the Motion Picture Association, but which is crafted in a way that's designed to parallel with his building of planes. Like, you have him in that meeting where he designs her brasserie, you know, where he's like, we are not getting enough production out of Jane Russell's breasts. Like, that's immediately following a sequence in which he hands a picture of the Hercules to his assistant, and he's been doodling both of them on paper idly. You know, you have the cloud expert who becomes the expert in breasts during that briefing in front of the Motion Picture Association. But even during those opening scenes, when he talks about clouds, he talks about Nimbus clouds being like gigantic big breasts. And you have this sense throughout that, like, what's actually bothering Hughes, what's actually getting underneath his skin, is this idea of intimacy and connection with other people. And you have this idea, you know, you have a parallel throughout. You have, so for example, Hepburn. He teaches Hepburn how to fly, and she kind of takes that from him. Yeah. But you have, in that introductory scene on the golf course, she's, I shower 7 times a day to keep clean, which is something that, you know, becomes kind of later on, you could argue, maybe informs his reaction against what's happening. You mentioned the kind of flames and the fire and the idea of purification that comes from those, where after Hepburn leaves, he takes, first of all, her clothes, but then his clothes, and then the clothes he's literally wearing, and burns them. And again, that's portrayed as an expression of, you know, that kind of like psychological disorder, that kind of like acting out, that OCD almost, that kind of like compulsive behavior. But it's also very much a reaction, even though he doesn't see it as such, a reaction to her departure. It's him kind of lashing out, or him acting out, but it's very much a kind of a response to that. You have that kind of sequence in the screening room where, before she shows up, the red light flashes and he's kind of bathed in red before Kate, who's, you know, Katharine Hepburn, with her distinctive red hair and kind of freckles, shows up on the other side of the door. And you have even like red lighting in the cockpit with kind of, oh, he says, you know, I hear you, Kate, I could always hear you, even in the cockpit with the engines on. And he's obviously alluding to the fact that they were flying together. But there's a sense in which his obsession with aviation, which is portrayed as something very tactile. He has, for example, he has another OCD attack when he's picking out the steering wheel, and his hands are actually touching the steering wheel, and he can't decide what part of the plane he wants to touch, the part of the plane that he's going to have to touch. He can't decide on what that is, and so he has a panic attack coming out of that, because again, it's this act of touching becomes kind of painful for him as well. And I kind of love that so much of the movie, while it is very much, you know, a historical study of Hollywood, a celebration of Hollywood, and a look at the life of Howard Hughes, is also, you know, a fundamentally kind of a Scorsese film in a sense of being about a man trying to connect, of kind of that intimacy, of kind of like trying to, you know, find a way to touch, or being afraid to touch, being afraid to come into contact with somebody else, of kind of opening himself up to other people. And I think that there's a lot in there. I think that there's a lot of weight in there, which is kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I think the point I was just trying to make was that I think, again, that it's not perhaps as unflinching as the best of Scorsese's work, even though it's very much in line with, you know, those other characters.
Oh, yeah.
The other comparison I thought of was that this is a film that ends with Hughes looking at his own reflection, as does Raging Bull, of course, with Jake LaMotta. I think we should talk a bit more about the craft on display here, because it's, as we said, it's, you know, with Scorsese, you always have to talk about the form and the content, you know. So his aim here was to recapture some of the visual magic of films that blew him away as a kid, and he wanted to use the range of colours that audiences were familiar with. So here the divide is that everything before the scene with the Hepburn family is designed to look like two-strip Technicolor, you know, where everything is like this weird bluey-green, isn't it? You know, like
turquoise.
Yeah, like the turquoise pee on his plate, or the golf course, the lawn on the golf course is what I was thinking of. And then everything from that point onwards, when we get to the Hepburn house, is more like three-strip Technicolor.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the most purely enjoyable aspects of the film, to be honest, just the kind of, especially that first period, you know, the process that's meant to be like two-strip Technicolor. I think it's just a marvel to look at, I think.
It absolutely is. It's completely stunning. And again, even that crashing sequence is another one where I think where he's crashing into the field and they're, all the grass and all the crops are turquoise as well. And it does give the film a kind of a distinctive texture. And you have a bit of that running through the film as well, where obviously Scorsese is, you know, a big fan of film, big proponent of film, and this was shot on film as well. But you have kind of editors and kind of like the cinematographer talking about like using digital technology, using an LUT, which is a lookup table, which allows you to do kind of instantaneous color grading and video editing rather than getting the film developed in a particular way, which allows you to basically kind of layer, like when you're watching the footage, when you're watching the kind of dailies, you can see what it will look like after that lookup table is applied. And so you have this kind of sense of Scorsese being, and again, this is the thing where, you know, we talked at the start about Scorsese as somebody who loves the history of cinema, the tactile kind of history of cinema, and who is, you know, nervous about the future of cinema. There's a tendency to overplay that where, you know, there are sequences even in this where you can see him using green screen. You can see him kind of emulating techniques that you see with digital cinematography where the camera moves through physical objects. I'm thinking, for example, of sequences where Howard Hughes is flying in his plane and the camera like literally moves through the windscreen to get a close up on DiCaprio. And like, there's a sense of Scorsese, you know, he isn't a Luddite. He isn't somebody who's kind of, you know, he isn't even arguably as extreme as Christopher Nolan in his kind of love of film as a kind of, as a medium, or as kind of a mechanism for recording. And so it's kind of great to see that watching The Aviator, where you have Scorsese using modern techniques or kind of relatively contemporary techniques and relatively, you know, contemporary craft to create a love letter to classic cinema. And I mean, you're entirely right that the first half of the film is astounding. That use of color is kind of striking and makes it look immediately very distinct from anything that was being released in Hollywood around the same time. Yeah. But what doesn't, you know, the tendency to talk about that wonderful kind of two-strip color design means that it somewhat overshadows even in the second half, which looks absolutely beautiful. Yeah, that sequence where Hepburn decides that she's leaving and has the conversation with him in his study, where you have these rich reds and browns, and it looks almost like something from, you know, like Gone with the Wind or kind of a contemporary kind of 1940s film. And again, to see that in a movie that cost that much money, released in 2004, is striking. And again, it's something that speaks to Scorsese's ability to create something that is at once a love letter to the history of cinema, but also entirely accessible.
Yeah, it's highly interesting because I think, and you've pretty much said this already, but the desire to create that vintage look, you might understand that as a nostalgic impulse, but just the fact that it actually entailed an immense technical challenge, you know, because it involved all these sophisticated digital means being brought in. And I think what he said became evident was that his decisions about color would impact virtually everything else, you know. And we kind of talked about a comparable situation when we discussed The Wizard of Oz, I think. But we're talking about things like how the set and the costumes and the makeup were all affected by this overriding choice. So, for instance, apparently Hepburn's dress, when in that scene where he takes a flying, it was a peach dress in reality, but it shows up as kind of a beige on screen. But yeah, I think there's something to be said about Scorsese as someone who, he's never really rested on his laurels, as far as I can see, when it comes to film technique. I'm thinking of how, like, Hugo, of that sort of batch of 3D films, that was one of the ones that used it the most effectively, I think. And of course, the aging technology in The Irishman is the most recent example. And that was one of the things I found a bit frustrating about the Scorsese v. Marvel discourse. And I'm talking mainly about online Twitter discourse, I think, really, is that it seemed like so many people were kind of proceeding on the basis that this was like an old man yelling at clouds situation. And I think it's very unfair to who Scorsese actually is. There's just one more element to that, though, which is that from what I understand here, though, there is an interesting wrinkle, which is that wherever they did have to outsource things, you know, so things like CG element creation or matte paintings, I think the visual effects supervisor, Rob Legato, said that they mainly relied on smaller facilities, you know, places run by two or three people. And what he said was that we wanted to keep the philosophy of handcrafting the film. And Scorsese said that, like, you know, these digital means, they're actually kind of liberating. They gave him more freedom than he had before in like a painterly sort of way. But I think that philosophy of handcrafting the film is an interesting idea. I think maybe that's what Scorsese was driving at. Maybe that's what, a point of difference with some of the films he was kind of aiming at in his kind of 2019 Firestorm. You know, I'm not sure he believes they have the same kind of philosophy.
Well, he has. He's talked about the difference between kind of like, you know, consumer-friendly art and product is how he defines the difference. And again, you know, I think he's being quite unfair to some of those movies, which is a strange thing to say about the highest grossing movies of all time. Gee, Scorsese, cut them a break. But, you know, no, that's somebody who, like, you know, likes some of those films, but also understands that for young people, those films will be a gateway into more cinema. And, you know, I think that, you know, that's good. And I'm hesitant to kind of call people out for that or to kind of shame them for liking them. But I do think that, yeah, that there is kind of like in that sense of Scorsese talking about them, he has been careful to delineate between the idea that he is, you know, that he's critiquing mass media in general. And again, you mentioned in the article that he talked about, like that New York Times article, which is very, very worth reading. He's very clearly on the side of populist entertainment, like going back and looking at the history of cinema. It's not like he's going, well, I mean, actually, if you look at, say, French silent films in particular or the German expressionists, it's like, no, he actually understands cinema is a populist medium and has always been very crowd pleasing. And there's nothing to be ashamed of in that. And even like, when he has those discussions and when he, that interview where he talked about the fact he couldn't get The Aviator made today, like The Aviator is to a certain extent a special effects movie. It has a couple of absolutely jaw-dropping sequences in it. And obviously they're created with CGI and are far, far, far safer than the scenes that they're emulating. I think that when Howard Hughes shot Hell's Angels, he lost three pilots doing it. He obviously had a crash himself as well. Obviously here it's all done by CGI, so there was no need to put people in that sort of danger, which is good. But they are breathtaking to look at. That sequence with the camera and the dogfight as he's kind of driving through it is dazzling. That sequence where he crashes the plane through Los Angeles, you know, sort of in the second half, is absolutely stunning. And spectacle, you know, I would argue on par with, you know, most superhero blockbusters in terms of like actual tension, actual scale, and kind of a sense of kind of majesty and a behemoth running through it. So Scorsese's critique of kind of Marvel isn't grounded in kind of that, well, movies have to be solemn and serious and there's no room for spectacle in there and there's no room for kind of special effects and there's no room for the use of CGI. He's mentioned that the difference with product is that his conception of product is that you're meant to consume it and just throw it away. And I think that's maybe where I think he's being a bit unfair to Marvel, because I do think that there are people to whom those movies genuinely mean a lot. I think like Wakanda Forever means a lot to moviegoers, and I don't think that it will stop meaning a lot. I don't think they're going to throw it away, you know, in 10 years time. I think in 10 years time, people who saw Black Panther in the cinema and were moved by it will still be saying Wakanda Forever to themselves or to other people, and it will still carry that weight. And I think that's what he's being unfair with.
But he always seemed a bit more emollient than people were giving him credit for, to be fair. Like, he said that, look, these films would have meant something different to me. I might want to make one of these films if I was a younger man. You know, it seemed like a lot of that was what kind of got missed out in a lot of the discussion, you know.
Yeah, that's fair as well. And I do think that, like, you're entirely right there when you mention, like, the use of 3D in Hugo, for example, the use of, you know, de-aging kind of CGI in The Irishman, where, you know, Scorsese isn't a Luddite. And again, this is one of those things where that binary debate that you have tends to reduce things down, you know, ad infinitum, to their most simple, you know, most caricatured form, where you do have, as you pointed out, the old man shaping a clouds that may or may not be shaped like breasts. But you have this kind of sense of, you know, the sense of like reducing Scorsese down to a grumpy old man who's watching the world pass him by. And you're like, no, have you watched a Scorsese film? And I mean, even in terms of even looking past like craft or technique, there are directors, you know, at the age of 20 who would struggle to have the energy that Scorsese brings to 3 hours of The Wolf of Wall Street, for example. And I think that, yeah, I think that, like, even in The Aviator, which is a film that is yearning for kind of old Hollywood, that is nostalgic and celebratory of old Hollywood, how much of the film unfolds in the coconut grove of the Ambassador Hotel, to pick an example of that? You know, the casting of Gwen Stefani, who had never acted in a film before as Jean Harlow, which is again kind of a wonderful touch of kind of sense of, well, I'm bringing old Hollywood to life, you know, necessarily without, you know, without kind of it needing to be a focus or without needing to justify it, but using new techniques to do that and having that point of intersection between past and present. Because again, yeah, The Aviator is a film about Hollywood's past, but it's also a film about where Hollywood was in 2004. And I think that it's inseparable. I think that you can't separate those two things. They exist on a line, a continuity between them. It's not well, the past was better, or, you know, the way we used to do things was right and we've kind of ventured away from that. It's like, no, the way we used to do things is great. And it's great that we can now realize that on screen without killing three stunt people, you know?
And I think, as in addition to that, I think maybe we can overemphasize Scorsese. Maybe we need to be more generous and acknowledge some collaborators, you know? Yes. So I'm thinking of the work of cinematographer Robert Richardson here. Now, somebody who'd worked with Scorsese quite a few times, beginning, I think, with Casino, and as recently as Hugo, if I'm not mistaken. And he's worked with a lot of people. He's worked with Quentin Tarantino on multiple occasions, for instance. Now, Richardson, as far as I can see, is someone who's very adept at lighting a scene in a way that reflects a character's behavior or their mental state. And I think what's great about The Aviator is that this is a project where that can be done quite ostentatiously at times.
Yeah.
So there are times where you have strong sources of light in otherwise quite darkened rooms, for instance. Like there's the scene where Hughes interviews Faith Domergue, where there's a real harshness to proceedings. But also things like the film premiere, where, you know, Hughes is clearly uncomfortable and everything's kind of overexposed. And in the hearings, that's relevant too, isn't it? We get a similar sort of effect there. The interesting thing that I mean, it's kind of on the nose, perhaps, in some sense, that this is a story about someone who can, like, conquer the skies. But then the interiors gradually become more confining as the film wears on. But the way it's done is just beautiful, I think. I mean, as strange as that quarantine scene is that we start with, it's got this distinct sense of, like, maternal warmth, hasn't it? Yeah. There's also a scene comparatively early on with Hughes at home with Hepburn, where the camera sort of takes a bit of a tour of the house in quite an untroubled way.
Yeah.
And then later we get the bathroom scenes and the screening room sequences and so on. So yeah, I wanted to move on to talk about the screening room scene in particular, but just in general, I think Richardson's work is outstanding.
Oh, it is. They apparently briefly considered shooting it, I think, in the 1.33 aspect ratio in order to kind of more faithfully recreate that old format. And they said that, yeah, there was no way that they could actually do that. They'd have to actually, you know, remaster it for kind of 1.88 and then have to kind of scale it in because cinemas at 2004 weren't designed to screen in that ratio. So what they did instead, and this is kind of actually really heartening and really warming, is you'll notice a lot of the compositions, while they are shot in widescreen, have the characters clustered around the center, so as to kind of evoke that old style of kind of filmmaking, which again is a nice subtle touch as an example of, you know, again, we mentioned at the start in terms of what makes Scorsese special is that sense of being, you know, acknowledging the past and kind of like referencing the past, but without being kind of beholden to it or kind of like, you know, without alienating anybody. So, you know, you're going to see The Aviator. It's going to be in the format that you're used to watching a movie for the most part. Sometimes the aspect ratio shifts, you know, as he jumps between newsreel footage or between kind of documentary footage or whatever. But generally speaking, it's in a form that you recognize. It's the same widescreen ratio that you would have gone and seen Ali in, to pick an example, you know, from around the same time. But within that, you have this incredible attention to detail. You have this kind of sense of the, you know, Robert Richardson and kind of, you know, Scorsese structuring the frame so as to draw your eye to the same place that they would draw it in a film from that period, even if you don't realize it, which is striking.
Yeah, so just on that screening room sequence, and I'm talking about where he kind of holds himself up in there for several days, it seems like. So Scorsese's talked about how screening rooms are extremely important to him. So I've got a book called Scorsese on Scorsese by Michael Henry Wilson, where he talks. Scorsese tells a story about an executive coming into his personal screening room where he works. The executive comes in to talk to him, and this apparently just infuriated Scorsese. You know, this should be a sacred space. I can't do business with this guy. You know, he described the screening room as a natural sanctuary. What he actually says was, everything's up there on the screen. Life, sex, the imaginary, everything. So I think it's also very interesting then to have someone who feels that way about locations like this direct the film, where he turns the screening room here into a kind of prison, doesn't he? And it's a beautiful scene. I think it's just incredibly well stylized, you know, like the spotlights on the milk bottles, that ominous red light bulb, which I think you mentioned earlier. Also when Alec Baldwin's character turns up and, you know, sort of blows the smoke through the keyhole.
Yeah.
And I've already mentioned the halo, but so I guess the halo provides some evidence of some of the more positive qualities of the screening room. But yeah, I just love that scene.
Yeah. And it almost becomes, and it's kind of that interesting kind of argument, that push and pull between it, where as an audience, we realize that this is a point of Hughes kind of like degeneration, where he's kind of collapsing into himself. He's becoming this kind of figure, this, you know, you have the moment where after Juan Tripp kind of leaves, he's like, yeah, they can't see him like that. You know, we should remember him how he is, how he was, you know, as opposed to how he is now. And a sense in which he has become this kind of like almost circus kind of sideshow figure. That wonderful camera kind of pull back, that zoom out, where it kind of pulls back on the wall and reveals all the milk bottles filled with urine, for example. Again, that's an example of kind of like that Howard Hughes of popular memory, kind of where you have to, if you're making a Howard Hughes film, you have to film a sequence in which there's urine lined up in jars, because of course you do. But like, even within that, I think that there's more of a kind of an ambiguity around it, where it's very clear that for Hughes, going out and being with people is difficult for him. And so the screening room almost is a sacred space in the way that Scorsese describes it. Like, and again, it's notable that when you talked about, like, Scorsese talking about screening rooms, it does almost sound like he's describing a sacred place. And for Scorsese, somebody who is almost a priest, whose work is informed by Catholicism, it almost makes sense that you have these Jesus moments that you described. You have those sequences where, for example, you have kind of the halo effect, or where you have him looking at pictures of the desert and kind of saying that the desert will make me clean. Again, that sense of like Jesus wandering out into the desert. And you have the sense of it being a moment of kind of, you know, he is lost there. It is kind of unraveling. And again, this is a point where Scorsese gets to go fully stylized in terms of filmmaking, where he doesn't have to, you know, there's no sense of this being, this reflecting anything more than the character's own internal psychological state. So it doesn't have to be literal. It doesn't have to be something that makes sense in kind of, you know, a linear ABC fashion. But you have this kind of sense of, you know, sort of like almost spiritual kind of journey happening there, an almost kind of spiritual connection, and kind of a delving into the self kind of happening. You have the shaggy beard almost that renders him almost Christ-like to a certain extent. And you have a sense of, while Hughes does have to go out into the world and he does have to go back out, he has to go to the Senate hearings, he has to assert control, and then he has to go and he has to fly his Hercules or his Spruce Goose, as it were, and he has to show the world that he can do it and that he gets to stay in America. There is a sense of that screening room, you know, whether healthily or not, being a space that he controls entirely. And again, there is something that feels, you know, again, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but something that feels very much like a director making a movie that is in part about the experience of making a movie or being a director, where it's like, yes, the screening room is this almost spiritual place. In another movie, you imagine that a character having the journey that Hughes has in the screening room would like go out into the desert and smoke some peyote or something, you know, and have that journey to spiritual awakening or kind of self-awareness. Now, it is obviously notable that, you know, he doesn't pull himself out of the screening room, as it were. You have one trip coming to taunt him, almost like Satan, who's like, yeah, just give it up. Just surrender it. Just, you can stay in that screening room forever. As long as, you know, you just sign over and let Pan Am buy your equipment, your stock, all your intellectual property. Just sign the deal and all this will go away. You can stay in the screening room forever. You have Hepburn coming to him and, you know, trying to get him out and being like, well, we can go flying if you want, or kind of, you know, thank you or trying to make things right. And in the end, you do have, you know, Ava Gardner who does a lot of the work of bringing Hughes back to humanity, taking him out, taking him back to his house, cleaning him up, pouring him a drink, and kind of convincing him that he can go out and he can talk to the Senate. So like, there is a sense in which, while kind of an ambivalence almost to this idea, because you do have the screening room as a space that is ethereal, otherworldly, and kind of, you know, almost religious, but it's also a place where he can't stay. It's a place where it's not healthy for him to stay. And again, there's that interesting kind of ambiguity, that push and pull between them, that I find fascinating watching the film.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Tripp as being like Satan, because when Hughes emerges from the screening room, it's framed so that he's in the frame with the Hell's Angels poster, but we can't see the second word of that title. So yeah, I thought it was interesting. Darren, I guess we're kind of almost wrapping up here. However, you know, we talked about a lot of the film, but there's a lot of film to discuss here. So what have we missed?
Actually, just a very small thing, but I absolutely love that kind of Hughes' go-to hiring strategy is, whatever you're getting paid, I'll double it. Which is like the worst negotiating tactic ever, but I kind of love that he kind of sticks to his guns. Like, how much are you getting paid? $5,000 a year? I'll give you 10. How much are UCLA paying you? I'll double it. You know, like, I do like that it's kind of a no-frills kind of like, I want this to happen sort of way. And again, you have that sense of DiCaprio playing that kind of high energy. Again, almost like a screwball comedy. It's notable that this happens in the first half of the movie a lot, where it's very much like, look at the energy of this character just kind of rhyming stuff off as well. I really kind of like that stuff. And again, that energy that the film has in its first half as well.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the emphasis on business is definitely simplified. And I think I saw somebody arguing that the film's kind of valorizing Hughes as an entrepreneur. But I think it's also fair to say that the precise nature of that entrepreneurship is largely kept off screen, isn't it? Like you say, just barks out orders. But yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not exactly like, you know, a pro-capitalist movie. It's not an anti-capitalist movie either. I just think it's like, well, Hughes was a businessman, so I guess we have to have him doing business. So what are we going to do? Let's just put in the style of like a, you know, again, the 30s screwball comedy. Like, you can imagine him walking through an office, throwing newspapers around, going, get on that. I want you to cover that. And when I come back, I want this bought. I want this matter settled. Yeah, see? You know, if this weren't... And again, what was the age rating on The Aviator, actually? I'm just kind of wondering. PG-13, actually, it turns out it was in the States anyway as well. But yeah, there's something kind of very, like, it's an adult movie, but it's an adult movie that is something that you could absolutely show kids, which I kind of love about it as well. I really, really like. And again, that screwball comedy energy is part of it, because that's a kind of an energy that I associate with a lot of those movies, you know, from the 30s, those kind of screwball romantic comedies where it's like, we're talking about stuff that kids won't get, but we're doing it quickly enough and with enough energy and enough jokes that they'll be entertained anyway. And there's a lot of that around how the first half of The Aviator operates that I really, really like.
Yeah, great stuff. All right, Darren. So I think we'll leave it there. But yeah, really enjoyed this. Thanks for coming on. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And before we do leave for today, I mean, where can people find you online if they want to hear more from you?
You can find me online at Darren_Mooney on Twitter. I write at the movie blog with a 0 instead of an O in the word movie. But if you just search for Darren Mooney, you'll probably come back with the blog quickly enough as well. So I co-host another podcast with my good friend Andrew Quinn called The 250. Carl's actually, we've crossed over with the Movie Palace a couple of times, talking about the movies on the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. So yes, hopefully as this is going out, you'll be able to join us in the middle of a discussion, a two-part discussion that we're having with the wonderful Tony Black, who I believe you may know.
Yeah, name rings a bell.
He does. Name seems vaguely familiar. But we'll be discussing Henry George Clouseau's 1953 Wages of Fear. And then Tony has also invited us to appear on his new podcast, The New Wave. And we'll be discussing William Friedkin's 1977 remake Sorcerer as well. So that will be coming out kind of in the middle of that. But if you are listening to this episode in particular, you may be interested in a series that will be running later in the year. I don't have an exact date, probably July-ish. But we'll be kicking off a Summer of Scorsese. I mentioned that, you know, Scorsese is one of the most, you know, heavily featured directors on the IMDb 250 at the moment, 7 films. So we'll be running through those 7 films. We're going to see if we can probably slot in Hugo as well around the same time. Hopefully we'll be able to convince Carl to join us for one of those discussions. So kind of keep that in mind for later in the year.
Yeah, and there may well be another crossover between our podcasts as well at some point, which I'm very much looking forward to. More details to come in future, listeners. Cheers, Darren. I think... listeners, you can find The Movie Palace at all the usual places, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. But I hope you've enjoyed our look back at The Aviator. That's all for today. So I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at The Movie Palace.
Previously on the We Made This Network. Pick a disc.
Particularly last night as well, it's like I did a late night run to IKEA to get...
I would imagine it's probably quite good running music.
Possibly, but I don't actually listen to music when I'm running. My running dipped a lot.
Run at all.
Yeah, but for the... in terms of driving up the M5/M6, it's atmospheric music. It's very atmospheric, like particularly if you're going at the speed limit.
You can't go at the speed limit on the M5. Always roadworks. Actually, I haven't driven on it for ages because it's always roadworks. It might be clear now.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast.
I remember Lance came by and picked me up to go to that, and as I was walking out to the car, we were meeting out at the car, and we saw someone's, or he saw someone's wallet, that somebody had lost their wallet and it was lying on the ground. And Lance you know, was ready to put the whole thing. I mean, we were, I think we might have even been kind of running late for this thing, and we really needed to get on the road and get downtown and get to this convention. But, you know, he picked it up and he wasn't going to go until we could kind of figure out whose wallet it was and how to get it back to them and all of this. And he just, because he saw it, he took ownership of that moment.
Without a mouse.
This week I have a very special guest. She is the co-host of the Tomorrowland Transit Authorities, one of my favourite podcasts, and she is also on YouTube with the channel Ivy Winter. It is Christine. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This episode's not going up till near the end of April.
Well, by that time I'll already been hopefully.
Oh yeah, that's true. Well, yep, yeah, we both will, because I'll be back by then, if the coronavirus hasn't closed the park down.
You know, I think Mickey will persevere. I think we'll be all right.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.